Hi, I'm Darlene Lancer. I'm a marriage and family therapist working in Santa Monica. I've seen individuals and couples for about 25 years, specializing in addiction and codependency, working at rehabs and teaching self-esteem and codependency in colleges and publishing about it. So I recently wrote Codependency for Dummies, and I'm going to go over the whole summary kind of the book is about 300 pages, so I can't get into it in deep, but just to give you an overview. So first of all, maybe you're here because you are in recovery or you're just curious. How many people think that they might be codependent and they're working on it in the audience? Okay, so some of you maybe you're just curious about it. I'd like to ask you to start with some common ideas about codependency, and just let me have a show of hands. How many people think that codependents have to be in a relationship? No. Or just shout it out. No, okay. That's correct. Codependents are involved with addicts or abusers. Okay. If you like to please people, you're probably codependent. Okay. Most codependents try to change someone else. You maybe there's a conflict here. Control is important to codependents.
Yes, that's true.
That's true. And recovery entails being physically or emotionally distant from another person. Okay. Well, a lot of them that you got right, originally when they started learning about codependency in the 70s, they were working with families of alcoholics. And so originally the term was co-alcoholic. And gradually they saw that when people left the relationship, or spouses of the addict, alcoholic, left the relationship, that their symptoms continued. And then later they found that actually the same symptoms were prevalent in people that grew up in families where there had been depression, abuse, mental illness, or just a dysfunctional family. Often if there was a controlling parent, for example. And some people manifest as trying to change others, but not all codependents. And there's really a difference between pleasing people because you want to and pleasing them because you think you have to. And we'll talk about that. So a lot of people just enjoy being kind and giving and pleasing others, but in their mind they have a choice. For codependents, sometimes they don't feel they have a choice. So some of the definitions that have been around for a few years or decades, first was Melody Beattie, who wrote the most popular book, Codependence No More, and she thought it was someone who was obsessed with and trying to control someone else's behavior. She was focusing on the relationship. Ernie Larson, a teacher and writer in the field, also looked at the relationship and said that it's someone who has a diminished capacity to participate in loving, intimate relationships. Then they started looking more at the history of the individual, focusing on their family of origin, and Robert Subby, a researcher, writer, thought that it was someone who was exposed to oppressive rules in their family. And John Bradshaw looked at it as a symptom of abandonment. Pia Melody would go along with that. She's another writer. She thought that if you came from an abusive family, that that was a necessary component. I somewhat disagree with that. I don't think your family has to be abusive. But my definition is a person who can't function from their innate self. And instead, their thinking and behavior revolves around another person, or substance, or process. So you realize this definition includes an addict. And it could be a workaholic, it could be someone who's addicted to food or sex, would be a process, gambling, or another person. My book focuses on the preoccupation with another person. I don't really go into addiction to substances or a process. Usually the person has to get clean or abstinent from that addiction to work on their underlying codependency. So here's an example of someone who's codependent. They have the real self, the innate self that I've mentioned, is shrouded to them. They can't really access it because there's a lot of shame and self-criticism that surrounds that. And then there's the persona that they show to the world. And it might be their personality is a pleaser, a good guy, or a nice girl, or a blamer, whatever that might be. And then outside is the perfect ideal self, which really compensates for their feelings of inadequacy or shame that they have with the shame-based critical self. And they're always failing. They're never quite measuring up to the ideal that they have, that they should be nicer, that they should be prettier or smarter or more successful. It may be different for each person. So I wanted to ask you what you think the symptoms of codependency are. You all agreed control is important. So the first one is denial. Okay? So probably everybody would say they know someone who's codependent. It's always someone else. Denial is called the hallmark of addiction. Denial is the first defense that we learn, that children learn. They'll just, you know, the first thing they say is, I didn't do it, you know, I don't remember nothing. So it's a simple defense, and it's necessary. If we thought about the fact that we're going to die all the time, we probably wouldn't leave the house. So there's denial, but I've divided into degrees and levels of denial. So the first one might be the denial that there's a problem in the relationship, or denial that you're being abused, denial that you're living with an addict. I've seen people where it's very clear that they think, well, the problem's anger, or the problem's depression. The problem isn't that their partner is stopping at a bar every night after work, or that they're just tired and they're actually passed out, or overdosing on prescription medication. Or their children are just going through a phase and they're just experimenting. They're not really abusing drugs or alcohol. Parents look the other way. And then denial of your own codependency, which I mentioned. You think that the problem is the addict or someone else. If only they would shape up, that you're unaware that you're contributing to the problem. And someone mentioned repression, denial of feelings. It's very common it's a core symptom that codependents aren't in touch with their feelings. They might be anxious or depressed or very angry, but there's other feelings that they're not feeling. They're hurt, they're pain. Many repress their anger. And denial of needs and wants. So they're focused on other people's needs and wants. And if it's extreme, some people can't even identify or name their feelings. And it's called alexithymia, when they can't even name what they're feeling.
What's it called?
Alexithymia. So, and sometimes they don't recognize a need, but it's in their... For instance, they need to have more space in a relationship, but they're not aware of it. Their partner is the one that's always asking for space. They just want to be close. And the partner, their spouse or partner who always wants to get away and be distant is not in touch with their needs for closeness and intimacy. So sometimes there's this splitting where some of their feelings or needs are in their partner. One spouse is always angry and the other one is not. So not in touch with their anger. And then there's repression. Another level of denial would be repression of past pain or trauma from childhood. So how do you know if you're in denial? Because you don't know what you don't know, right? Well, if you start thinking about how things should be, or if only he or she would, you know, be a certain way, you start making excuses for other people's behavior, or don't tell anyone. That may be a red flag that you're trying to hide something. You rationalize, you minimize it, you think things will get better. But with denial, things get worse. And you think things will get better despite evidence to the contrary. You believe broken promises. You know, I'll never hit you again, I'll never drink again, things like that. Or you think that on some future event, you know, when we have a child, when he gets a job, after we get married, and you start making concessions, hoping that things will improve. And a person mentioned low self-worth and low self-esteem. That's definitely a core symptom. If you're comparing yourself to others, you think you're better than others or less than others. Self-esteem is based on how you think about yourself. So you don't, and a lot of times people think they have good self-esteem and they're not really aware. They might even think that they have high self-esteem. And they're not really that aware of how much they criticize themselves. So if you don't think you can do something, you don't like too much attention, you can't take compliments, you don't want what you want, you think that your needs or feelings are less important than others, those are some signs of low self-esteem. Another core feeling is fear, anxiety. And it's often based on a fear of rejection or being alone. So codependents will stay in unhappy relationships. They may not be aware that they're afraid of being alone, but they're just stuck there. And the fears of being judged or rejected or being hurt, that will affect you getting close to someone and being intimate in a relationship and being honest and being assertive. And then the last two, fear of success and fear of failure, will affect your performance in work or even other interests and hobbies you undertake. So when codependents have been, when you've experienced shame in your childhood, often shame gets internalized. So it's really near the surface. Shame is a healthy, normal feeling. It helps people to adjust to a culture and be socialized. But with codependents, it's right near the surface. And some of the feelings that go with shame are, I'm a failure, I'm unlovable, I don't deserve happiness, I'm bad, I'm a phony, I'm a fraud, or I'm not enough is a common one. I'm not enough to be liked. People do extra work. Codependents are always doing the jobs that other people don't want or working too late at the office. They have to be perfect because underneath they don't think that they're enough or good enough. They're afraid of looking bad or being a failure. Sometimes they don't have good boundaries. I know someone who would always, instead of just working an hour for her fee, she would always work an hour and a half because she always thought she had to give more, do more. What she had to offer, who she was, really wasn't enough. And again, many of these feelings are unconscious. Dysfunctional boundaries are a real problem for codependents. And there's various kinds of boundaries. Oop, I think I skipped this slide. Guilt. Okay. So guilt comes from shame too, that I should do more, try more, work harder. Feeling responsible for other people's problems and feelings, that's really a core feeling for codependents. If they hear someone has a problem or expresses a negative feeling right away, they try to fix it or they start explaining and defending themselves. They are always afraid they made a mistake. They might review conversations before they have them. Plan them before they have them and then review them afterwards. They're always saying, I'm sorry. And then within themselves, they think they shouldn't feel what they feel. I shouldn't be angry. What's wrong with me? Why am I sad? So they don't really honor their own feelings. And here we go to boundaries. So the first one, I don't even know if you can see it. It's so faint. Fuzzy boundaries, and then broken boundaries, and then rigid boundaries. And boundaries become expressed in various arenas. One would be material, including money and property. Sometimes spouses have arguments over how much they should give their adult children, and one parent thinks they shouldn't be supporting them, and the other thinks they should. That's a boundary, a generational boundary, and a material boundary, how much money you should give or loan. Some people are rigid. They have trouble receiving and giving, and others give too much. Physical boundaries can include anything from looking at your privacy in terms of your things you write, your emails, your room. Do you keep your door locked or not? How much you reveal to others would be an emotional boundary. Often codependents either reveal too much or nothing at all. Or they trust too soon or not at all. They allow abuse, they don't have and then emotional boundaries come into play when you're feeling responsible for other people's feelings. You're sad when they're sad. You would feel guilty if you're happy and they're sad. You feel like you have to tone it down. Or you'd feel guilty. So sexual boundaries, of course, would be having to do with how soon you get into a sexual relationship. Often codependents have trouble saying no when it comes to that. Again, physical boundaries would be, an example would be how close do you allow someone to get to you, touch you, shake hands, things like that, including nudity around the house. So people get into relationships, their boundaries may be different based on their childhood, and then they have arguments over what's right or wrong. So when you get into a relationship, if you don't have a clear boundary, you can't really see this over here. I'm going to draw a diagram of it. But with healthy boundaries, if you have a whole healthy self, you still retain yourself when you're in the relationship. But if you don't, if your boundaries are fuzzy or broken, and you get into a relationship with someone, it gets unclear as to where you begin and where they end. So that's kind of a diagram of what I'm talking about. So someone mentioned attachment and dependency. So some signs of dependency would be pleasing because you're afraid of rejection. are afraid of that the other person will leave the relationship if you're honest. And then the focus on others comes from dependency. So some of the symptoms relate back to these core issues. Someone who can't get over a breakup, they keep pining over a relationship. Or they feel empty when they're alone. Their happiness is dependent on someone else and being in a relationship. They feel like their life doesn't have meaning, or they need some excitement. The feeling of falling in love makes them feel more alive. They don't have that resource inside of themselves. So, non-assertive communication. Did we skip a slide? Oh, I don't know. There was a slide that got missed. Anyway, non-assertive communication, someone mentioned passive-aggressive. Well, that's true, either they're, and manipulation. So those are some of the, next slide. Okay. Non-assertive communication, not making I statements. Often codependents, when you ask them, they waffle. They don't want to take a position, or they change the subject. If they don't want to make a date with someone, they will postpone it, make excuses, use avoidance. And then victim talk down here is when they're blaming and they say, well, you always did this, you always do this, you always do that, you never. Or they're justifying themselves, explaining themselves, defending themselves all the time. Here's an example of dysfunctional communication. They're telling someone what they should do, giving advice, criticizing, nagging. This is considered verbal abuse. So it's very underneath the radar. Verbal abuse isn't talked about very much, mostly physical abuse, but there's a huge amount of verbal abuse in our culture. So here's some of the reasons why people aren't assertive. They're afraid of being disliked or criticized, of rupturing a relationship. They don't want to be a burden to someone. They're afraid of retaliation. Maybe they grew up with someone who was angry if they spoke up. They don't want to hurt someone's feelings. So the communication between codependents becomes very reactive, and it escalates because they're not taking positions, they're reacting. So reactive communication is due to that weak self and the lack of boundaries, low self-esteem, or even past trauma can make you react to something in the present that really happened in the past. Responding is different. It comes from a sense of choice. It makes you think about what you want, what you need. It's constructive. So an example is if, let's say person A says, do you want to go to the doctor with me? So that's a question, right? It's not an assertion. And so what B might say, something else that's non-assertive, it might, well, non-responsive, he would might say, well, I planned on going to the gym. So he's not saying whether he wants to go or not. So you have another reaction, a non-assertive statement. A asks a question, B reacts, and then A might say, feel like, oh, the gym's a priority? You always do that, or say, well, I went with you to the doctor, some sort of reaction. This is a non-assertive. Okay, so what is B going to say? He could start defending himself or herself, or attacking or blaming, and it just escalates. Or B can take a position and say, I'll go with you, or I don't want to go with you. So, if you have two people that are taking positions, you have a much different result. So if A takes a position, and B takes a position, then you can negotiate. Okay? You could also force B could force A to take a position by saying, do you want me to go with you? So, by one person being assertive, it can make the other person more assertive. So in a healthy relationship, each person takes responsibility for their own needs and their feelings. They're able to nurture themselves, as pointed out. A very simple equation is if you meet your needs, you feel good. If you don't meet, if you ignore your needs, you're going to feel bad. So codependents have this warped sense of responsibility. Because they're other-focused, they think they're dependent on someone else's opinion. So if that's going on, then they have to control how the other person, they may do it by pleasing, they want to make sure the other person likes them and feels okay so that they'll feel okay. Rather than taking care of themselves, their focus is on somebody else. It's sort of like a haywire system. They're trying to figure out what the other person is thinking and feeling so they will feel okay inside. So neither person is taking responsibility for themselves, and one, here's a seesaw. Here's the person who feels responsible for someone else. I call it top dog. An underdog thinks I can't take care of myself. So this is often the relationships are out of balance. One person is more needy, the other is like a caretaker. So caretaking and controlling can come from not so much from love, but a need to be needed. And often in relationships where an addict gets clean or one person starts being assertive and taking care of themselves, the other person feels like they're out of a job. They don't know what to do. So codependent giving is usually with expectations, a need for love and acceptance underneath that they're really not aware of. And so they're trying to control something that's uncontrollable, which is someone else. And then they end up feeling resentful, their advice isn't taken, the other person isn't doing what they think they should do, they feel unappreciated and used. So top dog would end up thinking like, I'm okay, you're the problem. Top dog feels invulnerable, they're focused on the other person, they feel self-sufficient, they're usually over-responsible. If they don't give help, they feel guilty. If they feel sorry for themselves, it's the other person's fault. And they feel loved if they feel needed. Underneath, they really don't feel worthy unless they're giving and taking care of someone else. Underdog, on the other hand, is self-centered and feels like they need help. And they feel loved when they're given to, when they're receiving, and they also don't feel strong enough to be on their own. They don't feel really worthy of love if they were whole, only if they were receiving. So if you're always trying to take care and fix somebody else, you might end up feeling like Sisyphus because it's a never-ending job. Thankless and never-ending. Enabling, maybe, have you heard of the term enabling? Oh, you know a lot about it. Okay. So it's shown that for somebody else to change, the pressure has to come from within themselves. They have to experience the damage that their addiction is doing in their lives. I can share a little story with you that I, from my own recovery, and that was my son, I guess he was about eight or nine at the time, and he was always late getting ready for school and missing the school bus. And then I would take him to school on my way to work, which would inconvenience me or make me late. And we kept nagging him to get ready, and it wasn't working. So one day I said to him, you know, the next time you're late, you're going to have to stay home. And of course that day came. And he ran to the garage to see if his father was still there. It turned out his father had left for work too, so he was really scared. So I said, well, I didn't blame him, I didn't nag, I just said, well, I guess you're going to have to stay home. And I continued to get ready, and his little brother came to me pleading and saying, oh, he's so sorry, he'll never do it again, please let him go to school. Well, I waited, it was about a half hour before I was ready to leave for work, and I thought he had learned his lesson, so I did take him to school. He was never late again. So it was a lesson for him, and it was a lesson for me. So another typical symptom of codependency is anger and resentment. What do you think is wrong with this picture? What's going on here? She's not looking at him. What else? She's covering her ears, right? She doesn't want to hear. Turned off, yeah. And looks like he's being verbally abusive. But what she's not doing, she's not setting a boundary. She's looking away and covering her ears rather than saying, stop. I don't like what you're saying. So, some of the reasons that codependents get angry is because they're not setting boundaries. So they do things they don't want to do, they take abuse, they trust untrustworthy people. As I mentioned, they try to control something that's uncontrollable, then they feel resentful and angry. They take others' opinions personally from the lack of boundaries, lack of emotional boundaries. And their needs go unmet. And some of this comes from the denial that they're in a relationship with someone who can't meet their needs or won't meet their needs, and they don't know how to meet their own. In the later stages of codependency, a person ends up feeling hopeless, depressed, and despairing. From their chronic low self-esteem and shame, maybe they've had a series of bad relationships. They may be suffering from post-traumatic stress from childhood trauma. They end up feeling helpless and powerless because they can't meet their needs, they can't assert themselves. They begin to lose hope. So here I have a diagram of where all these symptoms we've discussed come from, and you see that the weak self that they're not aware of or they can't resource leads to addiction or focusing on somebody else. They can't regulate their own feelings, so they start controlling others, taking care of others. They're dependent because within themselves they can't sustain themselves. They have problems with autonomy, being on their own, or intimacy. And then the feelings of shame, anxiety, and fear and depression. And you see the broken boundaries makes them reactive. And they're not in touch with their needs, their feelings, and their communication ends up dysfunctional. So some of the origins of codependency go back, there's cultural influences and religious influences that may encourage, particularly with women, to not have a voice, to not work outside the home in some countries, or to be subservient to their husband. So these are some of these are gender-based roles. And there's also influence of the parent-child relationship from infancy, which I refer to as a psychodynamic. And it has to do with the how healthy the mother is. If the mother is codependent or is narcissistic or addicted or depressed or grieving something, it's going to influence the baby's development. And the healthy child is going to develop a sense of that self that I mentioned from the mother mirroring back the feelings that the baby has and being attuned to its needs and its feelings. So if a baby is crying and she's ignoring it or trying to play with it once when it really wants to be quiet, she's not tuning into what the baby needs or wants. And it's a feedback system with the mother and infant. They've done a lot of research in this area that helps the baby feel secure and know what its feelings are. One of the jobs of a parent is to say, oh, you're sad, oh, you're angry, and mirror back to the baby. But if that's not happening, what happens instead is the baby starts tuning into the mother and to try to anticipate what the mother is feeling. I'm saying mother, could be a grandmother, could be the father, but usually it's the mother, to get its needs met and starts adapting at a very young age to the parent. So part of this process is individuation that happens. From 4 to 6 months, a baby starts separating, has to learn to separate from its parent emotionally, and they start to learn that they're a separate human being. And individuation is actually an emotional, mental separation from your families, your parents' thoughts and feelings and perceptions, and you start to own your own reality and your own sense of feelings and perception. Learn to trust that. But in dysfunctional families, well, here's a functional family, huh? There was, why do you think this family was functional? I can't hear. Shout it out. It's a story. Yeah, well, they're happy.
It's television.
It's, okay. It's, they communicated, right. What else did they do?
They work things out.
They problem solve. Mm-hmm. Problems don't get solved in a dysfunctional family. They just react and the same things recycle. So here's some, you know, I had a look at television to find a functional family. So here's some symptoms of characteristics of a functional family. It's open. There's free expression of your feelings, your opinions, information from the outside comes in. There's no secrets or shame. And people are treated equally. Parents apologize. And there's fairness. It's not like what's children have to behave one way, but the parents can break the rules. And communication, as you mentioned, is respectful, it's honest. The parents listen to their feelings, they respect their children. That's establishing boundaries. So when there's blame and control, it's violating your boundaries. And that ends up, you end up as an adult with broken or weak boundaries. Also in healthy families, there's reasonable rules. You know what to expect. They're consistent. They're known. They're humane, and so the environment is calm, it's safe, it's nurturing. You learn how to nurture yourself because your parents are nurturing. You're able to trust your parents. You feel loved and lovable. And there's problem solving, as was said. And last year they had a convention for our adult children and normal parents. So, no one showed up. It's a dysfunctional family. And so, we them, that was typical of Archie Bunker. There's isolation. It could be we're better than, too. It's closed, it's inflexible. Appearances are often important. A lot of times these families look like the pillar of the community, and they may be involved in community organizations, but there's a lot of denial and secrets, things that you can't talk about. Even, for instance, we can't discuss that Grandpa has a limp. Or, you know, Daddy's hitting Mommy, or Mommy's passed out on the couch, but nobody talks about it. So you know that you can't, these things aren't, you're not allowed to discuss. And children then maybe the parents think everything, say that everything's okay, we're not arguing. So the children start to distrust their own perceptions. It gets very confusing. Often they're authoritarian. You're not allowed to dissent. And they've seen studies where if there's an authoritarian father, it can lead to codependency, or an obsessive, compulsive mother. So it doesn't necessarily have to be an addiction in the family. The children end up stifling their feelings, and they get repressed, is what was said. And they start to distrust their parents and authority. They feel like it's unfair. There may be abusive, shaming communication, saying like, you're never going to amount to anything, or why don't you act your age, or you're selfish, look at all I've done for you. Those kind of messages are shaming. Also telling a child that, criticizing, you're saying, you shouldn't feel angry. A lot of times in religious families it's not allowed. Or, you shouldn't, why are you sad? You shouldn't be sad. You should be, so just deny, saying that you shouldn't feel how you feel. And then parents often give mixed messages. An example from my own is when I'd break up with have a breakup with a boyfriend when I was a teenager, and I was crying, my mother would say, why are you sad? You should be angry. But I wasn't allowed to get angry at her. So those are mixed messages. Or sometimes one parent says one thing and the other says something else. It can be very confusing. And it undermines self-esteem. The rules are rigid or they're inconsistent. They may be arbitrary. Children that grow up in really highly dysfunctional families where there's abuse or addiction, they can get punished. They never know when they're going to get punished. So they, it's not really clear and what's allowable or what's not. And it's often very unfair, or the punishment might be extreme. Punishment, you can't go out for a month. No TV for a month. Something like that. Or being hit. So children learn to walk on eggshells, and they know that it's not okay to express themselves. And their feelings eventually go underground. And they learn that they have to be self-sufficient. They can't trust someone else. They can't rely on someone else. And they try to manage their feelings alone. So, also the boundaries. If they're if they're blaming, that's invasive. Or controlling, that's there's no boundaries. Or they could be very rigid. Some families, they don't hardly talk to each other. There's no expression of emotion. And they're very distant from one another. And often generational boundaries get violated if one parent confides in a child, let's say about the other parent, or often this happens after a divorce, that a child has to be like the little man, or, you know, mother, the little mother, and takes on an age-inappropriate role, and then their feelings and needs go underground, and they have to be there for the parent. And as it was said, nothing gets resolved in dysfunctional families. So what's recovery all about? How do you know when you're recovered? Well, you're more authentic. You're in touch with your innate self and you're able to express that. You know that you can get along by yourself and in a relationship. So sometimes codependents are so unhappy in relationships that they end up just being alone. And from having no boundaries, then they have rigid boundaries. They don't want to get involved because they were hurt too often. They can't get close to people. Sometimes they think they do great when they're alone, but when they're in a relationship, they lose themselves. So when you're authentic, your words, your values, your needs, your feelings are all congruent. What you say is how you really feel, and you're able to express that. And when you're working on yourself in recovery, it affects how you think, how you feel, your self-esteem improves, it affects what you say, what you do. And I've outlined about 8 steps, and the book really takes you through this chapter by chapter. And first is coming out of denial. And it's like peeling an onion. So a person may work on themselves for years and get out of a bad relationship, and then, let's say with an addict or abuser, they go into another relationship, and then they have intimacy. They're not being abused, but they have intimacy issues. So there's another layer there of their codependency to work on. And then focusing on yourself is the beginning of healing. As long as you're focused on someone else, you can't really change. Building that self so you get to know your feelings and know yourself, building your self-esteem, healing your past, learning effective, assertive communication, and then being able to set boundaries. It's really hard. You can't set boundaries when you don't know what you feel. Or if you're too afraid, or you don't know how to be assertive. That comes a little later. Starting to establish boundaries. And then finding pleasure and enjoying your life. People, hobbies. You're not just reliant on someone else. And then eventually pursuing larger goals. Pursuing your passions. So it's sort of a feedback loop here. You start to know yourself, your self-esteem builds. You take risks, you take action. You're not so controlled by your fears anymore, and you take new action, you start to know other parts of yourself and trust yourself more. It builds your self-esteem. You take more risks. And it's a feedback loop like that. It's a cycle. Codependency, if it's untreated, gets worse. So here in the beginning stages, this is referring to a relationship. You might meet someone and start to focus on them. You start to give up more of yourself. And then the later stages, you get more depressed. I'll discuss, break it down in a moment. And then when you heal, you hit a bottom. Something happens, you feel you really have to change. And then gradually you're building yourself, and then there's a later stage of recovery. So before I continue, I want to ask if there's any questions in the audience. I forgot to say it's okay to ask questions. No?
And this can apply also to friendships outside of romantic relationships.
Absolutely. Parent-child, all your relationships, work situations. But it's very interesting when I'm working with people and they start making changes, it affects their work. I've had worked with people who are supervisors and they can't give negative feedback to their employees. They feel like it's going to upset them. They feel too guilty. They take on too much work. And they're afraid to tell their boss that they need the work to be prioritized. Or they want to be paid for their extra time. So it affects all your relationships and definitely friendships. So here's a progression in the early stages of a relationship. The codependency, you might be attracted to someone, you start pleasing them, offering them help, gifts, you start becoming obsessed. Of course, you don't have to be codependent to want to please someone that you're in a new relationship with, but a codependent will take it to extremes and they start giving up themselves, and they might have some doubts. You know what? There's a mistake here. Joy's recovery should be on the other side. Okay. But anyway, they start having doubts about the person, but they're already hooked, so they start rationalizing and making excuses. Yeah, and then when they're in recovery, they hit bottom, and you start getting information, you learn about codependency, you reach out for help. You start to have hope. You start coming out of denial. You start learning that you can't change somebody else, that recovery is for you. And that's really crucial. Some people go into recovery hoping that it's going to change someone else. You don't know how the relationship's going to turn out. But I'll tell you one thing. If you change, it changes the dynamics of the relationship. And I've seen miracles happen when I've only worked with one spouse. And they start changing. The other person can't control them anymore, can't abuse them anymore, it starts taking on their share of responsibility for the relationship. In the middle stages is where a lot of damage happens or a lot of growth happens. And so when you're not in recovery, you start denying the pain that you're in. Start hiding problems, there's more anxiety, negative feelings, self-blame. Your self-esteem starts to suffer. And you become more and more obsessed with a person, trying to manipulate them by pleasing or blaming. Everybody's style is different. There's more disappointment because of broken promises and the inability to control the other person. There may be more mood swings or even turning to addiction. In the middle stage of recovery, you learn that you're powerless over someone else. And you really learn that at a gut level, not just intellectually. And you start learning about detachment. I handed out, Michael's here helping me, and there's some handouts if you didn't get them. And there's some tips there on letting go. And you start to take your focus off the other person. Start making other friends and other activities. You stop trying to control them. You learn to be assertive and take responsibility for yourself. And you have more emotional independence. You don't react as much. Somebody can't control you unless you allow them to. Okay? Someone can't verbally abuse you unless you allow them. It said that, you know, if you're allowing someone to verbally abuse you, it probably reflects how you talk to yourself. That inner critic, your inner pusher, your inner perfectionist, all that is how you treat yourself, is how you allow others to treat you. So if you honor and respect yourself and your feelings, then you're going to expect that from other people. So there's increasing self-care and beginning to look at your childhood and heal those wounds and set boundaries with other people. If you don't get into recovery and you stay in this unhealthy relationship, or sometimes even if you leave, you might start developing physical symptoms, stress-related illnesses. You become more angry, depressed, hopeless, even more obsessive, more compulsive, and your self-esteem plummets until you have that despair and depression. There may be more conflict and violence. And if you're in recovery, your self-esteem starts returning. You start knowing that you can make yourself happy and that it's generated from within. It's an inside job, folks. You start to feel your power. I think of empowerment as self-esteem in action. and you be able to express that self-esteem in the world. So you have a sense of your own power and develop love for yourself. And you develop the capacity for interdependent relationships and intimacy. And I discuss this in depth in the book, the difference between codependent relationships and interdependent relationships. And there's levels of relationships that where you can't have any autonomy or intimacy in a relationship, or there's degrees of it until you can really have interdependent relationships. So here's some tips for detaching. Learning about powerlessness and focusing on yourself, journaling your feelings, meditation and mindfulness. Do you know the serenity prayer? The serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Well, once you know you're powerless over someone else, that serenity prayer can be helpful. If you can't rely on the person that you're with, have a plan B. So that you're not so dependent on them doing what you want or coming through. Take a time out if you're in an argument. And by the way, the person who leaves a conflict should be the one to say, well, when he or she will get back to you. Say, well, let's talk about this later this evening or tomorrow. Rather than just withdrawing, because then the person feels left and ignored. Acting as if, just pretending for a while that you're not bothered, can help you learn to detach. And developing hobbies and friends and visualizing how you want to behave can be helpful. Here's in the handouts, let go and let God. The next one's my favorite, live and let live. Live your life and let other people live theirs. And the three C's are really well known in Al-Anon. You didn't cause the problem. When it's someone else's problem, you can't control it and you can't fix it. And here are four don'ts. Carl Jung said, to watch is not to love. Mm-hmm. So if you're watching somebody all the time and judging them, having hidden expectations, you start obsessing about them. And I would leave with you some reminders, I think they're in the handout, to mind your own business and don't give advice. That's like really hard for codependents when I hear somebody that has a terrible problem. They just feel like they have to tell the other person what they should be doing. So what you can say instead is, gee, you really have a problem. I hear you. That must be tough. You have a dilemma. I don't know what to do if you're asked. And usually you've never had the very exact situation. And even if you have had it, you're a different person than they are. Their priorities, their needs, their background is different than you. Again, journal about your feelings each day. So what can be really helpful if you have, review the conversations you've had during the day and ask yourself, what was I feeling in that moment? Was I really honest? What if you went through the day and were honest in every conversation, every interaction? Remember, no is a complete sentence. Codependents feel they have to explain. If they can even say no, then they feel like they have to give a lot of justifications. Or sometimes they tell the other person why they shouldn't do that or don't need them. Try to fix the problem for somebody else rather than just saying, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you. Or no, I don't want to go to that event. And this is really I have two number ones. Okay. They're equally important. Number three, when you feel bad, ask yourself what you need. Because repression of needs and denial of needs is so prevalent that you really have to practice learning about your needs. And the book goes into a lot of detail about what your needs are and how to meet your own needs and how to honor your feelings. So try to get in touch with really what you need and then take the action to do it. It might be reaching out to somebody, or it might be taking a nap, you know, or having some fun. So I think you may have some little cards that are handed out. I'm going to give away a free book. So if you, I have a mailing list if you want to sign up for, or if you give Michael the card with your email and name, I will draw a winner of the book. This book's also for sale. It's $16. I can take cash. I'd be happy to sign them if you want. If you don't have cash with you and have a PayPal account, you can also buy them that way. So are there any questions that anyone has that I haven't answered? Yes?
Are there more introverts or extroverts that are co-centered?
I don't think it matters.
It doesn't matter.
No. And just to really emphasize that I didn't, is that codependency exists on a continuum. So some people are extremely codependent, some people are minimally codependent, some people are codependent only with their children, or only with their spouse, or maybe in a romantic relationship but not at work. So there are degrees of codependency. Some people will have some symptoms but not all the symptoms. So it's really hard to diagnose yourself, but it really doesn't matter because there's always room for improvement. And you might find that you have some symptoms you want to work on, some characteristics, and others you feel really comfortable with. Any other questions? I want to thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
You're welcome.